Lunch and Learn. Why don't you kick it off?
Sure. Good afternoon. I'm Karen Mathias with the Council of Alaska Producers, a nonprofit trade association representing the large producing metal mines and the major development projects in Alaska. The Council of Alaska Producers is very pleased to sponsor this Lunch and Learn in cooperation with the House Committee on Resources. Our topic today is rare earth elements, which is a subject that's garnered worldwide attention on the potential of Alaska to have a role in producing these critical elements. Although UCOR is not yet a member of the Council, we thought it was very important for them to come and tell us more about the possibilities and the benefits of producing these metals. So thank you very much for coming, and I'll pass it over to Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Karen and Mathias and the Council for being here today, and thank you all for being here in the audience for the next in the continuing series of House Resource Committee Lunch and Learns. It's our effort to more informally encourage exchanges of information and views between legislators and staff and industry representatives and interested folks. Appreciate you being here. Again, the topic is rare earth elements and the progress of a rare earth project right here in Southeast Alaska, which is UCOR's Vulcan Mountain Dotson Ridge program. And here to tell you more about it is my co-chair, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Oh, yes. Today's speaker is a fellow named Ken Collison. He has more than 40 years of senior responsibility for mining operations and environmental affairs. He currently is a consultant and president of Collison MineCon. He provides consulting services to mining and consulting companies. He is the chief operating officer for UCOR Rare Metals, responsible for completing the feasibility study, followed by construction of a 1,500 ton per day underground mine and mill. He is the director of three other mining companies. Mr. Collison was at one time the chief operating officer of Thompson Creek Mines and Blue Pearl Mines. He was manager of the Village Safe Water Program for the state of Alaska. He has also served as vice president and general manager for Coeur d'Alene Mines Alaska, the vice president of Crandon Mining Corporation, and the president of Rio Tinto Tin Company. Prior to that, he held numerous positions with Rio Algon, with an emphasis on designing and building mines and major projects in environmental affairs. Mr. Collison holds a Bachelor of Science in Mining Engineering and a Master's of Engineering in Mining from the University of Saskatchewan. Please welcome Ken Collison.
I'm going to try this. I'm told it doesn't work 100% of the time. But I got a little bit of preacher in me, I think, because I like to wander when I talk. I hate it when that introduction comes up. I got to change it because I remember when I used to think 40 was old, and now I've worked for 40 years, so I guess that tells you what I am. I'm going to talk about UCOR's Dotson Ridge project. It's been a really interesting job because I didn't know what rare earths were, let alone what they were used for or how to say them. And so it's always fun when you're learning something, and so this has been a fun job. This is the slide our lawyers make us put up that if I say anything forward-looking that doesn't turn out, talk to the lawyers, not to me. And I'm going to start by talking about rare earth elements a bit. UCOR has developed a couple apps. If you're interested in the different rare earth elements and what they're used for, what the prices are, you can, if you got an iPad, you can download from the App Store a rare earth app that tells you that. And it's really good for trying to teach people about rare earths. Very well done. And then they've got one for the iPhone. It just gives you the prices, and it updates the prices daily. I don't know why he hasn't made it for other computers. I think the guy must work for Steve Jobs or something. The periodic table and the lanthanum series, it's called. Those are the rare earths. And there's 15 of them. And then they tack another one that's not up there on the end, is yttrium. So there's 16 elements that you're talking about. I can say all of them, except this guy. I haven't mastered that one yet. They all end with IUM, which helps. But I think some sadist came up with the names, because neodymium and dysprosium and all this kind of stuff are minerals I've never heard of. One of the big things with rare earths is there are light rare earths and there's heavy rare earths. And if you look here, the light rare earths are in the silver color and the heavies are in the gold. And that's rather significant, because the light rare earths aren't rare. And so they're not worth a lot of money. For the heavy rare earths, they're not worth quite what gold is, but They're rare, and there's not a lot of them around, and so they're worth a lot more money. And on this slide, it also shows some of the uses for them, and I'll get into that as I talk, because I think that's part of the important thing. The thing that separates Vulcan from the others is the amount of heavy rare earths. Mountain Pass Mine is in California. It has basically all light rare earths. They got 1% heavy rare earths. Where Vulcan has 40%. And so that's really what separates us from the others. And it's the heavy rare earths that car industry, airplane industry, the military are all interested in. And green. This slide was put together by the Department of Energy, and it's the importance to clean energy and the supply risk. And this is the most critical. And you can see it's the yttrium, the neodymium, dysprosium, europium, and terbium. So heavy rare earths. And that's where we shine. You don't have this without them. Basically, what a lot of them are used for is to make high-intensity magnets. And so if you want a small generator, for example, on a wind turbine, you have to use magnets made with heavy rare earths to make it light and powerful. Same with some of the other uses. I've showed this slide lots of times. It wasn't until this morning, one of the elected reps pointed out that that's not a Prius, it's a Volkswagen. And I'm a car guy. I restore old cars when I, I'm a car, I never noticed that. So maybe that's why I have the forward-looking statement at the beginning, because it's not a Prius. A couple interesting things. Interesting is there's over 25 electric motors in a Prius, and they all have heavy rare earths in them. And I fix old cars, and if you notice in an old car, the doors are this thick because the motor to raise and lower your windows is huge. Now they use heavy rare earths in those motors, so your doors are thin, they're lighter, you get better gas mileage, all that thing. The other thing is the electric motor for the hybrid car and the generator contain all the heavy rare earths. And again, that's to make them small, light, and more powerful. Department of Defense. About a year and a half ago, the state put on the first Strategic Metals Conference in Fairbanks. And a retired general spoke there, and I think he summed it up pretty well. And he said, there's two reasons we got the best armed forces in the world. One is our people, the other is our technology. And should we be relying on China for the metals we need to make our technology? Because over 95% of the heavy rare earths that we consume come from China. And if we're going to get into arguments, people, chances are China's going to be on the other side. China's already used rare earths as a political weapon against Japan when they're arguing over the island. They cut Japan off for a while. This is where we are, the end of Kendrick Bay. Prince of Wales Islands. We're in the southeast end of Prince of Wales, about 30 miles from Ketchikan. This picture is taken from the top of Vulcan Mountain. And one of the points I want to make is there's an old uranium mine up here called the Ross Adams Mine. People, intentionally or unintentionally, connect us with that deposit. We're down here. We're in a totally different area physically, and it's different geologically. We're not part of the old Ross Adams Mine. That mine, by the way, was mined, I think it was late 70s or early 70s. Two or three different companies did it. They mined about 100,000 tons, put it on a barge, and shipped it to Washington State. So it was a pretty high-grade uranium mine. This is a longitudinal schematic of the ore body. It's a series of veins. We call them vein swarms. And the little green lines are diamond drill holes. We just drilled off enough to give us an 11-year mine life. Because if you can't justify a mine with 11 years life, adding four or five more isn't going to make any difference. The ore body is still open at depth and still open on strike. But there's no sense spending millions of dollars drilling it. Let's do the economics. Let's do the design. Let's build the mine. Then we got all the time in the world to drill it. There's lots of other showings on our property as well that we haven't drilled. And so there's no reason to expect it's not like a Greens Creek or a Red Dog that have operated many times more than what their original study said they would, and they still got lots of ore ahead of them. And, excuse me, I've been fighting the flu. One of the things I say is, miners like to mine, so get the thing going, and we'll figure out every way possible to keep it going. And the trick is to get it going in the first place. By the way, that's Randy's job. I should introduce Randy. Randy McGilvery's on the side there. He's the permitting and community relations guy. And so his job's to get us the permits. So the pressure's on him now. This is the resource we used, 5.27 million tons at 0.65% rare earths. Total rare earth oxide is what that stands for. And 40% of them are heavy rare earths. And that gives us an 11-year mine life. Like I say, there's every reason to believe it's going to be there a lot longer. This is a picture of a longitudinal of the mine. Very similar to Kensington. Trackless, rubber-tired, diesel-powered equipment. The levels are connected with the ramp, like in a parking garage. And if we were going on a tour, we'd hop in a Kubota tractor. Away we'd go. We'd drive in the tunnel. You could go and drive up and down between levels in the ramp, visit whoever you wanted. You know, if your girlfriend or boyfriend was working there, you could drive up and see what they're doing. It's kind of cool. Farmers, loggers, and fishermen make great trackless miners. They know how to run gear and not break it. And that's the trick. This is a picture of the rare earth veins. The dark is the heavy or the rare earth veins, and the light is waste rock in between them. So we call it a vein swarm. And you can see this right on surface. You can walk 2 miles on surface right up this system and see it in lots of places where there's no muskeg over top of it. And these veins stick up a little bit because they're harder than the rock beside them and they haven't weathered as much. And so very easy to follow it and see where it is. It's going to be a camp job. If we could get a road, and there's a movement from the people on Prince of Wales to get a right-of-way, there's a federal bill going through, or to be presented in the Senate and the House federally in D.C., to put a corridor through the Tongass, because certainly if they were successful and we get a road built to here and to Niblack, people on POW could drive down instead of having, we'd have to take a boat. So it'll be a camp job, 1,500 ton a day underground mine, trackless equipment underground, I've mentioned. One of my pets is local hire. I looked after building a mine in Nova Scotia. It was in a small open pit with a mill and everything. There are two people in the mine that had worked in a mine before. One was the explosives guy, because we figured it's probably a good idea not to put a greenhorn on loading the holes and blasting them. The other was a shovel operator, because a pit shovel's worth $3 or $4 million, and we needed somebody that could train everybody on it. Everybody else was local, same in the mill. There were two operators in the mill that weren't from there, and they were wives of some of the mechanical supervisors. What that does for the mine, if you hire a person from Craig and start paying them $85,000 a year, they're not going to quit. You train them, you make them safe, and you've got them, most of them, for as long as the mine operates, or as long as they're, till they retire. And you know, I worked at one mine where you hired the fourth generation, which was kind of cool. But if you hire people from away, you're like the old days. You used to say you need 3 crews, one coming, one going, one working. And that's expensive. You know, training people and everything else costs a lot of money. And so if you hire local, you avoid that. It's also good for the community. We'll have about 190 employees, all told. This is a cartoon of the mining method, basically. You drive a 10-foot square drift here. You drive, it's about 65 meters below, or 65 feet below, you drive another 10-foot wide drift. You drill 2-inch holes down this way, you blast it, muck it out, so you end up with an opening like that. But then you fill that, and you fill it with tailings from the mill process mixed with cement. And so you take the ore out, you replace it with basically sand with cement in it. That way you can mine all the ore. When you leave, there's no openings. They're all filled. This is a schematic of the surface. You can see up here, there's little green lines. That's the ore body. These are the old roads that go up to Bokan Mountain, which is up here. And you can see where the ore body actually goes under Kendrick Bay. So there'll be a typical mine site. You have a camp and an admin building, you know, bunkhouse with a cafeteria. There'll be a small tailings pond here, and I'll talk about that. and then a water management pond, so any water we collect will go here and be treated if it needs to be. And there'll be a waste rock facility here that I'll talk about. Some unique technology. First is ore sorting and magnetic separation. Ore sorting is pretty cool, and I've got a picture that I'll show. But what it does, it rejects. After you mine it, you crush it to minus 2.5 inches, and it rejects half that material as waste rock. And that's what the waste rock pile is for. So you end up with, in a 1,500 ton a day mine, you end up with 750 tons a day of minus 2.5 inch rock. The rest goes through the grinding circuits and through the mill and back as tailings, which you make into backfill. So we'll have 750 tons a day of tailings. But the mine needs 1,025 tons a day of backfill. And so all our tailings are going to go back underground. And when we're finished, there'll be no tailings on surface. Also, 250 tons a day of our waste rock will go back underground because we need it to fill the openings so we can mine above it, below it, and beside it. And so we'll be the first mine. It's one of the things that makes this job really neat. We'll be one of the first mines that I know of, or the first mine I know of, and when it closes, there'll be no tailings on surface. Should make Randy's job easier. The other, and I'll go into this more detail, is solid phase extraction. It was a process invented by IntelliMet, which is three PhD chemists from Stanford, dad and two sons. The dad was the director of the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab. These guys are brilliant. I don't know if you watch Big Bang Theory, but it's one of my favorites. And those guys remind me of these guys. You know, they're absolutely brilliant. As an engineer, my problem is getting them to quit doing tests and come up with something practical and use it. And they've done that. We've done their process in the lab. We're going to pilot plant it. And it has big advantages, and I'll get into that in a minute. This is a picture of the ore sorter. It was developed for the recycling business to separate tin cans from plastic bottles. And then it was adapted for the mining industry. And I saw it at a tungsten mine in Austria, and then the diamond mines in the Northwest Territories use it. And it's magic. You crush the ore minus 2.5 inches, and you screen it into four different size ranges. The fines don't go through the ore sorter, but the others each go through their own sorter. And the ore comes, I didn't want to do that. The ore comes down here, and in our case, each rock is X-rayed. But they can also do it by color, they got half a dozen different ways they can do it. And so the computer then sees this, and the blue is ore, and the red is waste. And it remembers that. This is where the magic is. And when it comes off the end of the conveyor belt here, there's 80 air jets, like this. And if a piece of waste comes off here, this air jet goes poof, and blows it on the other side of the divider. And so we'll feed 1,500 tons a day from the mine, but we only have 750 tons a day of feed for the mill. It rejects 50%, recovers about 95% of the mineral. Big cost savings, because one of the big expenses on a mine site is power. And that's from the grinding mills. We'll only be grinding 750 tons a day instead of 1,500 tons a day. And it gets us so we can put all our tailings back underground. Pretty slick. We've run 20 tons through a production unit in Germany. We got another 30-ton sample sitting in Ketchikan right now. It's going to Germany. We'll run that through one of these, and we'll use the upgraded rock to run a pilot plant, which we hope to get going in about 3 months. This solid phase extraction is a nanotechnology, and it's hard to explain. They've got a website. If people are interested, you can go to IntelliMet.com. But I'm not a chemist. That's why I'm in the mining industry. I did really well in chemistry in first year engineering. I thought I should be a chemical engineer, not having a clue what a chemical engineer did. Took it in second year and I hated it. So I drank and chased the girls. And they asked me to leave. Well, I was 18. I wasn't going home. Goodness knows, I didn't want to face my dad. And so I got a job working underground up in northern Manitoba, lived in a bunkhouse with 350 guys. You grow up in a hurry. And I did that for 2 years, had a nice red convertible, a little blonde girlfriend, but I realized I wanted to go back to school. So I went back and took mining engineering because I loved it. And I'm glad now I'm not a chemical engineer. So I'm a bad one to explain this because this is chemistry, but I'll do my best here. It's a nanotechnology, and it's in columns. And the process is you crush and grind this 750 tons. You run it through a magnetic separator where the mineral that we want is magnetic and it sticks there. That separates another 50% as tailings. That's waste. The other 375 tons a day goes into a leach circuit. And you mix it with 90 degree centigrade nitric acid. That dissolves the rare earths into solution. The nitric acid that isn't consumed is recycled back into the front end of the circuit. And the pregnant solution, which is the nitric acid solution with the minerals in it, goes into this process. The first thing they do is they separate the nuisance minerals. This is a granitic ore body. All granitic ore bodies that I know, like the tin mine we built in Nova Scotia was a granitic ore body. There's a little bit of uranium and thorium in it. And this is no different. It's a granitic ore body, so there's a little bit of uranium thorium. So the first thing this does is it takes that out. That'll go back in the tailings, go back underground in the cemented fill. So it'll go back where it came from. After that, there's a series of these columns. They're anywhere from 100 gallons down to 250 milliliters, so smaller than a Coke can. And inside is what they call a spider web. To me, it's a porous sponge. And they coat the sponge with certain things that will attract a particular ion. So if you want to get dysprosium out, you coat it with whatever, and it attracts the dysprosium and it sticks to this sponge. It happens very quick. And then you rinse that and get the dysprosium out. But it goes through a series of these columns, and we're going to be producing 16 elements. And so there'll be 16 different sets of columns at the end to separate each one. And so we're going to pilot plant it because it's never been used. But it works, like I say, it works in the lab. We've produced a number of the different things. And so we'll pilot plant it just to give it credibility, and then we'll put it in the plant. So right on site, we'll be producing the 16 different rare earth elements. Very quickly, as I said, so these are very small. So it has a low capital cost. A typical separation plant to build is $200 to $300 million. Our total project is like $221 million, including the separation plant. So big difference. A bit of a timeline. PEA, that's the preliminary economic assessment. We used to call that a scoping study, but somebody decided they needed a fancier name, so they call it a preliminary economic assessment. Basically, what it is, it's a million-dollar study sort of thing that says, yeah, this is a good mine, it's plus or minus 25%. This is a good project, let's spend $6 million and do a feasibility study. And so we've done that. The next step is permitting, that's Randy's job. He's got the easy job, you know, he's got to deal with the regulators. I couldn't do it. We've been collecting baseline data for about 2 years. Then the permitting process, we got to do a plan of operations. And that'll take some period of time. We're going to do the feasibility study. It'll be done by the end of the year. And it takes about a year and a half to build the site. The big question you don't know on any schedule you do is how long is it going to take to get your permits? Now, having no tailings on site should make a big difference. Having a very small footprint should make a difference. I meant to mention, and I forgot, the waste pile that's there. We're going to produce 750 tons a day of minus 2.5-inch rock. We're going to put 250 of it back underground as backfill because we don't have enough tailings. So we're going to have 500 tons a day of minus 2.5-inch rock. We've got some of it now up in Anchorage. They're doing tests on it to see if it's aggregate. Right now, Alaska imports their hard aggregate for their paved roads from the southern 48. So we should know in another week or two whether ours is hard enough to replace that. Now they never use 500 tons a day, but we're on deep water, so we're going to have empty barges going back south. We can put it on there. And I got that idea because when I looked after building the tin mine in Nova Scotia, there was a fellow there who had a quarry on deep water, and he crushed it, screened it, put it on a barge, sold it in Texas and Florida. And Randy, tell you, I like to tell stories. This guy decided one day, you know, my barges are going past the biggest market in the U.S., and that's New York City. Why don't I sell it in New York City? So I went to New York, started visiting a cement plant. The second day he was there, he walked back to his hotel, and these two big dudes came up, one on each side, and said, "Mr. Whoever wants to have a little chat with you." They put him in the back of a limo, and this guy said, "Look, my grandfather provided the aggregate in New York City. My grandchildren are going to. How do you want to go home?" And this was in the 1980s. So needless to say, he went home and continued to sell his aggregate in Florida and Texas. But if he can do that, certainly if we can produce aggregate, you know, there's no reason at all we couldn't sell some in Alaska and sell the rest in the Southern 48. The results of our PEA is, I'm going to be done early, Linda. She's watching me like a hawk here.
She does that.
Yeah. Well, I've gone to a lot of mines, and no matter what mine you go to, there's one person that makes that person, that place tick, and keeps everybody out of trouble and on time and everything, and it's always a woman. Never fails. You know, and if you ask my wife, she'd tell you the exact same thing, because that's the way she is with me. You know, she's the one that makes sure I get to there on time, and I've always told her if we get divorced, she has to remember my ties and my jackets and shirts, because I'd never have a clue. You know, I'd look like some guy off the back street somewhere, because I wouldn't have a clue what tie to wear. Anyway, PEA, pre-production capital, $221 million. That includes a $25 million contingency. A PEA is a plus or minus 25 to 30% estimate. And again, it's a preliminary study just to say, yeah, this is a good project, or, well, maybe we shouldn't, or maybe we should do some more work. This obviously turned out to be a really good project. So now we're going to do a $5 or $6 million feasibility study. In a feasibility study, you get into much more detailed design. Because number one, you need it because the estimate is plus or minus 10%. And number two is you need a lot of it for your permitting process. Because there's certain permits you need to apply for. Well, you need some fairly good engineering in order to fill out the permit application so they won't just send it back. And so in a feasibility, you get into some pretty good detail, in some areas more than others. But it generally costs something like $5 or $6 million. And there are a series of binders that would, you know, fill this table and fall off one end. Because you might get 7 or 8 binders that are this thick with all the report and maps and, you know, financial tables and everything else. So it's a big effort. You have to do a lot of metallurgical work ahead of time. We'll be doing some more test work. And as in our case, we're going to pilot plant it. Not all projects are pilot planted. But we're going to do a pilot plant where we'll take 30 tons of ore sorted rock and run it through a small scale mill, basically. And, but the main reason we're doing that is to prove up the solid phase extraction technology. Rate of return was 43%. I wish I could get that in the money I got in the bank. So very, very strong project. The net present value, financial people and accounting people who understand that. But basically what they say is they take the profits you earn every year and bring that back in today's dollars. And this says you're going to spend $221 million and get back $577 in today's dollars. So good deal. Payback in 2.3 years. So within 2.3 years, you get your $221 million back. So very robust economics. 11-year mine life. But again, like I said, there's no reason to believe it's not going to be longer. It's open at depth. It's open on strike. And there's a lot of other prospects to drill. But we got to get it going first, and then we get lots of time. It's easy to expand a mine. It's hard to get it started. So the first thing we got to do is get it permitted and built. We'll produce 2,250 tons of rare earth oxides. That includes 95 tons of dysprosium oxide, 14 tons of terbium, 515 tons of yttrium. And those are sort of the three critical ones for the clean energy business, the defense business. That's what makes your cell phone vibrate, is there's a little wee dysprosium magnet in there. That gives it, and it has to be small and strong because you don't want to have a 5-pound cell phone, not like the big boxes you used to have to carry around. And so that's in there. A guy made a bet. If you put two dysprosium magnets together, you can't pull them apart. A guy made a bet and he put magnets in each corner, and it floats which I thought would be pretty cool. My wife didn't. But so we thought we're opening an office in Ketchikan, and we thought it'd be really neat to put a platform there that floats so the kids could come in, you know, and McDonald's has proven if you get the kids there, the parents have to come. And so the kids would want to come in so they could stand on this thing and float in midair. And then we'd have a chance to explain to the parents what our project was. But after doing a little research, we found that dysprosium magnets are so strong, they can stop a pacemaker. So we didn't want to particularly see a headline in the Ketchikan Daily News where Pete Moss went to visit the UCOR office and his pacemaker quit, and his funeral would be held on Wednesday. We figured that wasn't a good idea. So, but anyway, this was a new one we put together. One of the key ones is dysprosium. The kind of green color is the U.S. demand, and this odd gold, green color, yellow color is Dots and Ridges production. So we're going to produce almost half the dysprosium of what the U.S. needs. And so pretty significant. This is what the Department of Defense is talking to us about. We've gotten a grant from them through the Defense Logistics Agency to do some more of the research in the pilot plant, and they're continuing to talk to us. We've got a number of the major companies in the Southern 48 that are talking to us about getting takeoff agreements. And what a takeoff agreement is you sign an agreement with them and you'll deliver X number of tons of a certain product to them over the life of the mine. And hopefully they give you some money when you sign that. If not, you didn't negotiate very well. But so we're a fairly significant producer. When you get up into these, it's not as much. You know, we produce about a sixth of that and 10% of that. But there's some that are critical and a lot of interest. Because people have seen what China has done to others. And I was in the molybdenum business. That's what Blue Pearl was when we bought Thompson Creek, a major molybdenum producer in Canada and the U.S. And when we were buying Thompson Creek, people said to us, what do you want to buy a molybdenum company for? China produces all the moly. They're the cheapest producers in the world. They just put you out of business. Well, lo and behold, China's no different than the rest of us. They got cheap mines, and they got expensive mines. The price of moly dropped a little bit. China shut down a bunch of mines. They're starting to consider the environment, and so they shut down some for environmental reasons. And lo and behold, they now import moly. Rare earths are doing the same thing. Excuse me. Every year, China's reducing their export quotas and using it as a political tool, as they taught Japan and the rest of the world, over a little island they both thought they should own. And they cut off Japan. Well, Japan makes a lot of hybrid cars and electric cars, and all that kind of stuff, green technology. And their sole source was China. So, you know, it's critical that we start doing this kind of stuff. There's a lot of metals that we rely on foreign sources. And a lot of foreign sources now are getting pretty iffy. You know, there's a lot of upset in Africa. There's a lot of upset in South America, which are major mineral producers. Certainly China, as I've mentioned many times. And so people are starting to talk about that and starting to say, you know, we better take a look and see if we can't start developing our own resources more rather than relying on some of these continents and countries that are, you know, pretty iffy these days. One of the things that both Randy and I really believe is government, well, community relations, more, well, and government relations, but community relations. Local hiring training. We've met with the Ketchikan Indian community. They have a training center where they teach trades in Ketchikan. They're putting in a dormitory, and that's critical. You know, if a kid from Prince of Wales or anywhere in South Southeast wants to take up a trade, most of them can't afford to leave home and rent a place to live that's expensive. Like, for a kid to come up here to go to UAS, to learn how to be whatever trade he wants, and, you know, a mechanic, it's pretty tough. This is not a cheap place to live. Well, Ketchikan Indian community is putting in a dormitory now. And so it'll be much cheaper and more easily available for people from outside the Ketchikan and Saxman community. So we've been dealing, Chaz Everettson is the push behind all this. We've been dealing a lot with Chaz and in talking about programs, this type of thing. Kluwak isn't up there, but Kluwak has a grant to start building a training center, a trades training center in Kluwak for Prince of Wales. We've got some work going on now at University of Alaska Fairbanks. We're working with University of Alaska Anchorage. And we've talked quite a bit with University of Alaska Southeast. If you ever get a chance, in their minor training section, they've got this simulator. And it's pretty cool. You can tell I'm not very good at video games, though, because you sit in a chair, and they can put a console in front of you of any of the major underground equipment that's identical. And this platform's on cylinders or something, so it moves. And you got surround picture and sound, and you can drive, say, a 40-ton truck underground. And I tell them not to keep score when I did it, but they can keep score. And when you hit the wall, which I did frequently, you get the crash sound, the seat bounces, you know. And so they're using that to train people to help them get jobs right now at Greens Creek, Kensington. It's in a container. It cost about $1 million. It wasn't cheap. But it's pretty cool. You can only get on it for about 10 minutes because most people after that get seasick. And so they limit their students to 10 minutes each. And I can attest to that. I was on there for more than 10 minutes because one of the UCOR guys wanted to take pictures. And eventually I said, I got to get off of here because, you know, it's like I'd been out in the open water for too long. The other one we're spending a lot of time on is I believe it's a lot easier to deal with people that understand what you're doing. So we've been visiting a lot of the communities on Prince of Wales. I knew a number of these people because of Village Safe Water. We did projects in Ford Bay and Craig and different places. And so that's helped. But we got a few left to go. We've been talking with the people in Ketchikan and Saxman. We've met with the fishing groups there a couple of times and talked with them. We've been very well received. You know, the people in Prince of Wales and Ketchikan, they want jobs. And when you tell them these jobs are going to pay $85,000, $90,000 a year, you know, it's a pretty significant income. We create 190 jobs typically. There's two or three other jobs created for every job in the natural resource business. And so it could have a big impact with us in Niblack, particularly. If Niblack gets going, it could have a pretty significant impact down there. And they've got high unemployment. You know, it's some of the, I think it's the highest unemployment in the state is down in that area. We've done, Craig had a 3-day mining symposium. We made a presentation there. We made a presentation to the Ketchikan AMA. We're making a presentation here to the Alaska Miners Association's conference this week. And so we spent a lot of time, and we're going to continue to spend a lot of time meeting with people, talking to them, letting them know what we're doing, because it's the right thing to do as far as the communities are concerned. But it's also, like I said, it's much easier to deal with people and understand what you're talking about. And so that's part of both our jobs. And it's part we both enjoy. Government outreach, well, that's part of the reason why we're here today. Same thing. It's a lot easier to deal with a legislator that understands your project. They may not agree with it, but at least they understand it, and it's much easier to talk to them and talk to about your project. Strong support. The people on Prince of Wales, Craig, John Bowling, got after Senator Murkowski and Begich, and Congressman Don Young. There's a proposal in D.C. right now to establish a road corridor through the Tongass. So at some point, somebody can build a road from Heidelberg, the road system in Prince of Wales, down to these sites. And that's not coming from us, although it's a big boon for us. That's coming from the people on Prince of Wales. And that tells you something. And then there's a resolution, support resolution, which is part of the reason why we're here as well in the state. And I mentioned we've got support from the Department of Defense. What's coming? We got a new resource coming out. The resource we use for the PEA didn't include the drilling we did in 2011, so that's being updated. We're going to award the feasibility study this quarter. We're going to secure the takeoff agreements I talked about with some of the major companies in the Southern 48. this year. We're going to award the pilot plant work this quarter. So what do we got? We got a deposit with a high percentage of heavy rare earths. We got a project with very robust economics. Very small footprint, no tailings on surface. A new technology that results in the production of individual rare earth oxides. And this is one it's one of my interests. And this and one other that's not up there. I think there's a real opportunity for the state to take rare earth oxides and keep going up the food chain. There's no reason why we can't be the only people in the United States producing rare earth metals, rare earth magnets, and maybe rare earth motors and generators. You know, we've got a bunch of buildings in Ketchikan from the old pulp mill. There's an industrial site in Gravina. It'd be very easy for us to take our product to those places and bring her up the food chain and develop a new industry for the state. I think, to me, that's really exciting. You know, I've lived in Juneau 16 years, and to be able to do that, there's nothing more gratifying. The most gratifying thing I've done in my life was when I went to Nova Scotia, and it was Bush. We built a mine, we employed 225 people to go to work in the morning and see 225 people at work supporting their families, making a good wage because we built a mine there. And that's really cool. You know, that gives you goosebumps when you see that kind of stuff. Actually, there's one other point I want to make. A lot of people think mining is dangerous. And mining companies do a lousy job telling people about this. It drives me nuts. I worked in the mines in Ontario, which has a lot of underground hard rock mines. You had more chance getting hurt than losing a shift of work, stocking shelves at Walmart, or working for the provincial government, than you did working in a mine in Ontario. And they don't tell people that. You know, we built and operated an underground mine with 525 employees. We ran it for 2 years without a single lost time accident. So nobody cut their finger or twisted their ankle to cause them to miss one shift of work. Most people don't know that. Like, I worked in Toronto office, the company I worked for a little while, and people said, "You worked underground?" I said, "Yeah." They said, "Oh, I can never do that." They said, "Well, how'd you get to work this morning?" "I took the subway." I said, "Yeah, you're underground." But there's a misconception, and it's the mining company's fault. We opened up the mine in Nova Scotia. We said there was a town of about 15,000, 30 miles this way, town of about 5,000 that way. We said to the employees, "Look, will you donate your time on a weekend so you can open up this mine to the public?" So seven of us are sitting around saying, "How many people are going to show up?" Because we thought, "Oh, we'll get some pop and some chips and stuff." So he said, 300 on Saturday, 400 on Sunday. Saturday, 3,000 people showed up. It was unbelievable. Fortunately, we had it set up so buses just were going back and forth to the pit, and we had a path that they could walk through the shops and the offices and through the mill, and our employees stationed along the way. Sunday, 4,000 people showed up. So they had to wait an hour and a half to get in the parking lot, and they did. And they didn't have a clue, really. Women showed up from church in dresses and high-heeled shoes to walk through the mill, and the mill's got those steel-grated floors. Mm-hmm. And they'd open the door from the office to go out onto the floor, whoa, you know, because they had no concept. And that's the flaw of the mining industry, is they just don't get out and tell people what they do. And people are interested. Like I say, there were 7,000 people showed up out of a population of about 20,000 people in the area. Blew us away. You know, as I said, we thought we bought enough pop for 300 people. It didn't last very long. So to me, it's a real flaw in the industry. I say they got the foxhole mentality. I keep my head down in my foxhole and hope the grenade doesn't land here. Instead of getting out and telling people what they do well. And safety is one of them. So that's part of it. Great opportunity in the state. The other opportunity is I've gotten to know a company that's going to barge liquid natural gas. They have a contract with Alaska Marine Lines. They've approved all their containers. And we did our PEA based on generating our power with liquid natural gas. CAT has an adapter for all their generators so that you can run your generator in 80% natural gas, 20% diesel. It lowers our power cost 28 cents a kilowatt hour to about 16. Now, being in village safe water, I've gone to a lot of villages on the Yukon, on the coast, all junk. You almost felt guilty building a sewer water plant because they had to buy the diesel to provide the electricity to run it. And very, very expensive. Bad enough here, but even worse in the villages. And if you could convert them to LNG, and this company has a package they just bring to your site, you bolt it down, and then the container of LNG comes in, you set it down and plug them in, and away you go. If because of weather you run out of LNG, the generator can run back on 100% diesel. And so a really slick system. And I think there's a real opportunity here in the state to start looking at that. When we get our own LNG plant in Alaska, very easy to change supply. The infrastructure is already in place in these. And away you go. I've talked to Kensington. Kensington's looking at it. They can use it for mine air heat. They can use it for their power because they're generating power with diesel. And so to me, it's something that people, wherever I go, I bring this up because I think there's a real opportunity for us to help out a lot of people that are really living on the edge. And mainly because they can't afford to pay their power bills, let alone buy groceries. That's just a picture of Kendrick Bay. We're on deep water. It's, you know, a real opportunity here. We can bring all our stuff in right to the site by barge. Like I say, the ore body goes right under Kendrick Bay. We haven't drilled it, but you know, you can mine underwater. I was at a mine where we were mining under a 600-foot deep lake. So, you know, with underground you can do that as long as you have competent rock. We got very competent rock. So we're supposed to have some time for questions, so I'm going to call it quits. Any questions?
I've got one. I'm Representative Doug Isaacson from North Pole, Fairbanks area. Thanks for your presentation. When you mentioned the rare earth metal seminar a year and a half ago, at that time there was a VP from UCOR that came up and actually helped to give him a tour of the remains of the nanotechnology facility that we have up there. Dr. Shiva Hullavarad is in charge of the strategic technologies. And at that time, it looked like UCOR was going to be able to do some processing with the university. Could you talk about what you're doing with the universities right now in processing or using our technology to develop your project? Yeah.
The state gave a grant to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, I think it was $300,000, to do research on rare earths. And we're supplying them the rock, and they're going to start by doing a various sort of preliminary tests, and then next year they'll get into the more detailed work. Basically this year they're going to do mineralogy and that kind of thing to understand the minerals in the rock, and then next year they'll get into leaching and separation. So UAF is working at it. We've been through UAA, and we'd like to start some stuff there because each university's got their own separate set of skills.
Do you see that as you talked about developing industry up the food chain? Do you see that as an active participant that you can be to develop the new industry for Alaska?
I would hope so. Right now, we certainly don't have the expertise to even understand the process. But you know, all that means is you got to hire the people to do. You know, that's what makes things work, is the people and their brains. But you know, once we pilot plant this and we're sure that the SPE is going to do what it says it'll do, and I don't see why it won't, then I think we'd all better sit down and take a hard look at, you know, what can we do to add value to it.
Thanks.
Yep.
Ken, if I may, I want to acknowledge Representative Isaacson. Representative Steve Thompson was here. We had Senator Bernie Gardner here a little bit earlier to listen in. But could you speak a little more in depth about global deposits of rare earth elements versus global production? You know, we have some here in Bokan Mountain.
Yep.
Are there other locations in Alaska? Where's the world deposits?
There are some other prospects in Alaska. UCOR has some claims in Ray Mountain, Ray Mountain. It's along the Yukon. They're a placer type deposit, which is, you know, a lot of the Chinese deposits are in clay. They're a carbonatite, which is a different type of rare earth minerals than what we have. There's quite a few, I forget the number, but there's a lot of rare earth prospects in the state. There's some others that, there's a lot of junior mining companies that have projects. There's a number of way up north in Canada. There's one in Sweden. Most of them are light rare earth projects, and I'd be surprised they see the light of day because of that. Because, you know, light rare earths, once Mountain Pass gets going full bore, they're going to produce a lot of light rare earths, mostly cerium. And so it's hard to see. Basically, the forecasts are light rare earth prices are going down, heavy rare earth prices are going up, is the gist of it. Yep.
Out of curiosity, rare earth prices are going up because of China's reduction in their exporting. If this comes online and others come online, don't you see that that price will probably go back down?
It'll probably go down a bit. Usually does. But most of the other projects are quite a ways out, time-wise. Most of them have huge infrastructure they have to build because they're in the middle of nowheres. You know, one of them, they got a good ore body, but they're up by Great Slave Lake. And so infrastructure to build a project like that is very, very expensive and takes a long time. And so I think we're in a very good position, being on deep water, being in Southeast Alaska. And it's always a race in the mining business to be the first one in the play. And so that's, right now we figure we're the leader weeder. Anything else? Yeah.
Ken, your was a good presentation, by the way. If this mine goes on and you produce like you're proposed to do, how much of the United States demand for rare earths would come out of this mine?
Well, the one slide showed we produce about half of the dysprosium. After that, it gets down anywhere from 10 to 35%, depending which metal you look at. So there's still lots of room for somebody else. So, you know, but Mountain Pass isn't going to do it. You know, Mountain Pass only has 1% heavy rare earths, and they haven't quite figured out yet, from everything I'm told, how to get their neodymium out of the ore, which is one of their heavy rare earths. So,
can I ask a geology question? Do rare earth elements and uranium occur together, or why are they deposited where they are?
Randy's a geologist in the crowd, so he's probably going to laugh when I try to explain this. One of the first things they teach in mining engineering is how to give geologists a hard time. And I'm sure they teach geologists the same thing. But basically, I think my understanding is Bokan Mountain was an intrusion from the core of the Earth. And there's sort of like spokes going out from it. And so on the spokes, there's minerals that came up from down below two or three times. He's smiling already. And deposited these minerals. And so where Dotson Ridge is, they're high in rare earths, very low in uranium and thorium. When you get to the core in Bokan Mountain, they're high in uranium, very low in rare earths. And so being a granitic ore body, all granitics have uranium and thorium in them. Your granite countertops have some. I would hope not much. But you know, all granite has some uranium and thorium in it. And like I say, the tin mine, we had shaking tables, and the heavies go to the top and lights go to the bottom. And this was Rio Algum that ran some uranium mines in Elliott Lake. And there was this little dark streak across the top because uranium is very heavy. So we sampled it and we sent it to Elliott Lake. And the only answer we got was, how much of this can you give us? And because it was a granitic ore body, there was a little bit of uranium in there. You know, and that's the nature of the beast. But not enough that it's going to cause you concern when you go underground or anything like this. Yep. That's it.
Okay,
thank you.
Ken, thank you very much.
Put up the shotgun right here,
just like that, and then you paint this out, and so it's basically just like it gets kind of everything in that general area.
Yeah.